partnership. The quadrilateral security dialogues bringing together United States, Japan, Australia, and India, but such an alliance may provoke a spiraling set of reactions from other Asian players, such as China and Russia.
Consequently, this week, the OECD...
Leaders of the four-member Quad grouping, or the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, held their first summit mid-March 2021, but the strategic partnership, presumably against China, was in the making since the beginning of the century. The Quad was first established by then-President George W. Bush following the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami and, after a long hiatus, was reconvened by Donald Trump in 2017. Its advertised aim was fostering a free, open and inclusive Indo-Pacific region, but the implicit goal was to address concerns about Beijing's growing economic influence, military prowess and technological heft. Although this year's virtual meeting focused on non-military initiatives and China was never mentioned in any statements or proceedings, the Quad has the potential to further divide the already complex geopolitical arrangement of Asia. Its extension, or the Quad Plus, including France, Canada and perhaps the United Kingdom or New Zealand, may prompt a counter-axis with Russia or Pakistan in tandem with China.
India and three other Quad countries have recently kicked off a major naval exercise, along with France, in the Bay of Bengal. Such drills may be seen as a show of military might by these countries who don't mention it, but are apparently concerned about China's growing military. But Quad wants to be more than that. The members of the Quad and some of their friends believe the baby alliance has also the bandwidth to challenge non-security frontiers of Beijing's global influence.
The March 12th summit wrapped up with no direct reference to China, but the joint statement by Quad's four leaders was telling of a different story. The Quad leaders established working groups about COVID-19 vaccine development as well as cooperation in emerging technologies plus climate change. On the first glance, they seem irrelevant to China, but they are aimed at addressing the broader aspects of Beijing's central position in the global system. China is a pivotal player in international supply chains. This had never been so noticeable for the Quad members before the pandemic necessitated universal vaccine production and distribution. The Quad seeks to restructure supply chains to wean them away from Beijing. Another Quad initiative is to undercut China's influence in telecom and biotech. And climate activism is only there for the global appeal. All of these members have other bilateral or multilateral alliances or PACs specifically for the promulgated goals of Quad. They did not deliver, so what makes them expect a different result from a new name or clothing?
Now, to learn more about Quad and its purpose and aims, we have with us Mr. Victor Gao. He's the chair and professor of Suzhou University and the vice president of CCG. Mr. Gao, welcome to the program. So, what are the consequences of the formation of Quad, or as some call it, Asian NATO? Can we even call it an Asian NATO?
First of all, I think the fundamental premise for the formation of Quad, that is an informal alliance involving the United States, Japan, India, and Australia, is very much misplaced. Why? Because I think in the world of today, people want to have peace and development rather than having a resurgence of another Cold War or a conflict leading to a total war. And from the Chinese perspective, any attempt by one country or several countries to form a so-called alliance to contain China will be a failure, because it's impossible to contain a big and great country like China with 1.4 billion people bent upon peace and development. And China is now contributing anywhere roughly around one-third of any additional GDP growth for any given year in recent years. Therefore, to contain China and try to stop China's peaceful economic development is suicidal for the United States and other countries. Therefore, I think Quad, if it is designed to contain China, will be a miserable failure. And you can call Quad by any other name, for example, Asian NATO, for example, it will not be a success. It will not deliver the results that its member countries want to see it deliver.
All right, so you think it's a failure and it would be suicidal. Now, can India use Quad for its own gains?
I think you need to ask Indian government or some experts in India for this question. From our perspective, I think India is a developing country, it's a non-aligned country. It will serve India's interest better if it continues its non-aligned position, because that's really the core and the strength of Indian diplomacy for the past several decades. Secondly, India can really do a big favor for its own people and its own government if it maintains a focus on peace and stability and maintain good neighborly relations with its neighbors, including with China. China does not want to have a conflict or a war or confrontation with India. Both China and India are great countries with ancient histories, and we share a very long land boundary with each other. And both China and India need better investments and need to do more to improve the living standards of the Chinese people on the one hand and the Indian people on the other hand. We do not want to have a war. A war is not good for China. The war is not good for India. So let's talk peace rather than talk about war.
Now, how would China see or react to such a potential alliance?
Now, first of all, I don't think there is such an alliance to start with. What they are talking about is a very loose structure with no written document endorsed by their parliaments, elevating their relationship into an alliance. No, it's not an alliance, a very loose structure to start with. Secondly, I don't think these countries or these people really want to contain China. Why? Because it's a mission impossible. How can you contain a very big, important country, the biggest contributor to the global economic growth, the largest population in the world, and one of the strongest military in the world? So I think these countries will realize, including their people and their government, they will realize the futility of such attempt to contain China and the destructiveness of the attempt to set up a so-called alliance involving these four countries. These four countries aligned together will not be able to defeat China or hold China to the ground. They are talking about complete indulgence in fantasies rather than talking about realities on the ground. The Chinese government and the Chinese people do not want to have a war or conflict with any of these four countries. We want to have peace with them. We want to talk about business and cooperation and economic and financial cooperation included, for example. So we have better things to talk about rather than war or conflict or confrontation.
All right, that's a very interesting point. Now, isn't the Quad just another way of America to have military presence in the region?
Well, the United States is very much the mastermind of Quad, whatever it means and whatever it will evolve into. And I think the United States is really very much losing its own sanity over the rapid economic development over the past decades. And the economic disparity between the United States on the one hand and China on the other hand is very fast narrowing. As of the end of last year, China is already about 70%, if not a little bit more, than the United States, compared with the United States in terms of the overall size of the GDP, if we use official exchange rate as the benchmark. And there are lots of economists who are talking about that by another 10 years, if not even less, the Chinese economy, if we use the official exchange rate as the benchmark, will surpass that of the United States. And I think in China, we are very much confident that given the unity of China, given the strong leadership of China, the execution ability, delivery capacities of the Chinese government, and the overall support of the Chinese people for the peace and development strategies adopted by the Chinese government, China will surpass the economic size of the United States in about 10 years, if not even less. But does that mean that China wants to replace the United States as the top dog in the world? No. I don't think the Chinese government or the Chinese people want to be the top dog of the world. We want to see a world in a multilateral format, and every country, big or small, will be treated as an equal sovereign. And that's very, very important. And I think we all need to rally behind the United Nations, and we should not do anything to bully other countries, to violate the legitimate interests of the other countries, and to put yourself on top of the United Nations.
All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Gao, for being with us on our program. It was very nice having you. Before moving ahead, let's just take a quick look at what's been going on cyberspace and social media.
Ronald Van Keekum has talked about the NATO-style alliance against China. Tom Fowdy has made fun of US double standard policies. He highlighted that Washington is only a friend to India in its rivalry against China and nowhere else. Navendra Tripathi called Quad the first step in the formation of a bigger front against China. Rab Rakha believes China should counter a threat such as Quad, and he believes it starts with doing something about India. Memory has tweeted a quote by a Chinese professor downgrading the Quad.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In India, more than 20 policemen were killed in a recent ambush by Maoist militants in the mineral-rich state of Chhattisgarh. This came about a month after another similar attack by Maoist Naxal militants who have been waging attacks since 1967. The recent rise of Maoist attacks in India has revived concerns about this decades-old insurgency that has appeared largely contained. What does this resurgence mean for India?
Maoist militants, often referred to as Naxalite or Naxals, trace their roots to communist politics. They use violence against the state in the name of championing the cause of India's poor and marginalized. Naxalite groups have been active in the country since the 1960s, but the modern insurgency did not begin until the early 2000s. Since 1967, the group has asserted control over vast swaths of land in central and eastern India, establishing a so-called Red Corridor. The reach of the outfit was once so widespread and their attacks so frequent that in 2006, India's Prime Minister declared them the country's single biggest internal security challenge. The Indian government has hunted many of the insurgent leaders, killing a large number or forcing them to surrender. This, along with years of infighting, has declined the insurgent attacks in frequency and potency. Nevertheless, the group continues to launch hit-and-run attacks, ambushing security forces in friendly terrain and inflicting casualties in deadly battles.
According to data by the South Asia Terrorism Portal, over 100 people have been killed this year, and it's only April now. More than 2,100 civilians in India have been killed in the Maoist insurgency since 2010. The government's inability to contain such a homegrown insurgency has a heavy and bloody cost for the civilians and security personnel alike in areas under their reach. And the prospects for peace look dim because these areas are among the poorest in the country. Bad living conditions feed such an insurgency.
Although the insurgency has largely weakened since the 2010s, the well-planned ambush of this march and incidents of this kind are far from a novelty in the Maoist hotbeds. The change of Maoist leadership in late 2018 was seen as the return to increasingly aggressive tactics, such as assassinations of prominent figures and multi-pronged hits. But the ongoing pandemic seems to have impacted the insurgents' supply lines, thus hindering further attacks. The Indian government needs a coherent, long-term remedial approach. The current situation is paradoxical. Authorities turn to military force saturation and rely on disproportionate kinetic responses in Maoist-prone tribal areas. This keeps these regions underdeveloped and inhabitants unhappy, which in turn boost Maoist recruitments.
Now, to have more insight about the Naxalites and the Maoist insurgency in India, we are joined by Colonel Danveer Singh, who is an associate editor of the Indian Defence Review. Mr. Singh, welcome to the program. So, what do Maoists in India really want? Are they a serious threat?
Okay, this is a very interesting question because generally people think that it is a movement of some sort of separatism. So, let me make it very, very clear that Maoist movement is not a separatist movement. It is a movement for regime change. These people follow the ideology of Mao from China, and they are not happy with the democratic system prevailing in India. They say that it is a capitalist system that exists in India, inherited from the Britishers. It oppresses the weak and the poor, and the oppression is by the capitalist people, and the state is representative of these oppressors. So Maoists want to free the country from the oppressors per se, and they want to establish communist rule exactly on the lines of the Chinese Communist Party. So this is what their whole agenda and idea about this insurgency or this violence is.
The cost of government's inability to control the Maoists are the lives of the people. How can India handle the Maoist insurgency?
See, this Maoist insurgency is to be handled on various fronts. I personally feel, very firstly, it is to be handled at social level, wherein the people, affected people, or the people who reside in jungles and remote areas, they have to be provided by some kind of social security. When we talk of social security, it involves medical, it involves food, it involves various other amenities that other people do enjoy. Then we have to carry out administrative reforms, because administrative reforms are key to building a trustworthy connect between the poor, downtrodden, and those who are ruling or the system. So to integrate system with the people, you have to carry out administrative reforms. And administrative reforms are absolutely necessary because they are very archaic. We have inherited these systems from the British. They are not Indian system. They are not sensitive to the local way of thinking and living. So that is another point. Then we graduate on to other aspects of military. That is, we have to counter the propaganda war of the Maoists with great intensity. And lastly, we have to carry out friendly operations, military operations that do not harm the locals, but they target the Maoists. So we have to function on various levels, like I mentioned, to repeat them again. We have social, administrative, information, and military. So these are the four prongs that we have to invoke to counter the Maoist strategy. Otherwise, Maoists will continue to have their grip on the very low and far-flung strata living in the jungles of central India.
Now, during the time of Premier Manmohan Singh, it was believed that Naxalites or Naxalism was the greatest threat to Indian internal security. Do you think it is still the case?
As I mentioned, what Manmohan Singh had said in 2010 was absolute reality, because that was a time when all the disturbed areas combined, that is to do with the northeastern region, Kashmir, and the Maoist Red Corridor, it almost made up to 70% of India's landmass. That was very huge. That was extremely huge. So when he said that, that was a very right thing that he said that. And now things have changed. While the India will still be 70% in a sense that the ideology or the Maoist ideology still resonates in the corners, but when it comes to Maoist insurgency, it is not that 70%. In that 70%, I included Northeast as well. So today, when we are talking, Northeast is virtually or literally free of insurgency, literally free. And Maoist insurgency out of 6-7 states, it has reduced and is confined to a very limited area of a small state called Chhattisgarh. That is all. Kashmir insurgency has also come down drastically, which is also on the verge of complete collapse, because it is also breathing its last. So when we look at the complete scenario and that 70% that I quoted, I don't think so. It is more than 10 to 15% as you and me are talking.
All right, Mr. Singh, thank you so much for being with us on our show. It was really nice having you here. Now, before ending, let's just take a quick look at the social media and cyberspace and what they think about the Naxalites and what's going on in India. Thank you.
Siddharth Kaushal believes that the Indian government should do whatever it can to contain the Maoist insurgency. ARI Videos has shared videos to commemorate all those killed in Maoist attacks. This account with the handle Global Cyber Police says, with proper resources, he can eradicate the Maoist insurgency.
And this concludes our episode on the Quad Summit and the Maoist insurgency in India. We shall meet next week.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Recently, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's office has been accused of backing a report that argued that the United Kingdom is not institutionally racist, which itself has been torn apart by experts and analysts. And Boris Johnson himself, of course, has a long record of having made racist and bigoted comments. We now present you an article written by Richard Sudan, a journalist, writer and television reporter. The piece is titled Boris Johnson's Premiership Total Failure. Ordinary people pay the price. Please stay with us for more of Richard Sudan's article. It seems at times as though everything Boris Johnson touches results in complete shambolic failure. For many living in Britain, this reality is not new, nor is it new to the millions who, interestingly, in spite of his track record, voted for him as London Mayor and ultimately as Prime Minister, fulfilling Johnson's long-held dream of running the country. But Boris Johnson's leadership as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom has been nothing short of a complete, unmitigated disaster. And his ascension to the highest office in the land arguably serves as one of the ultimate examples of career opportunism, and also duplicity. The latest claims and allegations levelled at Johnson align perfectly with his track record so far. And despite those claims, including the suggestion that Boris Johnson said he'd rather see bodies piled high in their thousands than order a third national lockdown, Johnson, for the time being at least, continues to weather the current political storm. Politics in Britain is in crisis, and Boris Johnson is standing firmly in the middle of the storm. It's no secret to those with an understanding of his career that Boris Johnson always harboured ambitions to be Prime Minister and seemed to be of a mindset from a young age that it was his right, almost destiny, to enter number 10 Downing Street. Boris Johnson's own sister has spoken of how Johnson, as a child, had professed ambitions to supposedly become world king. Perhaps this partly explains why Johnson, despite the carefully crafted image offered to the public, is so dangerous. And dangerous he certainly is. His belief and conviction of his own right to rule at whatever cost to Britain, means he might do just about anything to remain in power, in the face of all the evidence underscoring the fact that he's simply not fit to serve as Prime Minister. The current shambles of the government reflects this reality, whilst Boris Johnson's own track record proves it. At the time of writing, and not for the first time, Boris Johnson is trending on social media, with many calling on him and demanding he leave office. The current state of affairs in Westminster and around the country was predictable, certainly when considering the past. Boris Johnson failed as a journalist. To be precise, he was sacked in 1988, for fabricating claims made in an article. He was sacked as a shadow minister in 2004 over charges about inappropriate affair in his private life. But as London mayor, and after a few stints as a pundit on television, Johnson was able to revitalize his image and use his platform as mayor of London to endear himself to many in the public. His subsequent rise to become prime minister and his time in office since have been no different. Boris Johnson staked his prime ministerial campaign run on being an outspoken proponent of the Leave campaign in the run-up to Brexit, regardless of the revelations indicating he had no real serious ideological commitment to either position. As Prime Minister, Johnson then made the entire general election, in which he was eventually victorious, about Brexit, pledging to get Brexit done successfully, persuading many communities who may yet prove the hardest hit by Brexit to vote for him. Whilst in office, Johnson famously prorogued government in order to push through his widely criticised no-deal Brexit plans, a move which was later ruled as unlawful by the Supreme Court. And again in office, Boris Johnson was hit with claims of yet another improper affair in his own personal life. Recently, Johnson's office has also been accused of backing a report that argued that the United Kingdom is not institutionally racist, which itself has been torn apart by experts and analysts alike. And Johnson himself, of course, has a long record of having made racist and bigoted comments. Sadly, the problems characterizing the leadership of Boris Johnson seem endless, and all, of course, arise amid a backdrop of other very real problems. While Britain attempts to emerge from the grips of a pandemic that threatened and still threatens to cripple the National Health Service, the NHS. In recent days, media reports questioned the means by which Boris Johnson paid for the refurbishment of No. 10 Downing Street may not surprise those with a keen eye on developing political situation in the United Kingdom. But what should not be overstated is the seriousness of the overarching claim that has shocked millions of people. Reports of Johnson allegedly stating that he would rather see bodies piled in their thousands than order a third national lockdown, if true, reaffirm a different kind of shallowness and selfishness. Thousands have already died due to the coronavirus pandemic. Many would argue that countless deaths could have been prevented had Boris Johnson taken serious action and much sooner over the pandemic. Johnson himself contracted COVID-19 and by his own admission was saved by the same NHS, which many now believe is under severe strain due to his decisions and the actions of his party. While in most circumstances the controversy surrounding Boris Johnson might have led another leader in another nation to fall on his own political sword, Johnson survives. But at what cost? Boris Johnson continues to survive a political storm of his own making. It is not the first time he is clinging on to power, and it symbolizes a so-called democracy and country in deep crisis. Whilst millions of people around the country continue to live in a reality and within circumstances that will simply never be felt by either Boris Johnson himself or his cabinet of privileged millionaires.
Economic divide.
The JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal negotiations are happening in Vienna. That's between Iran and the P4 plus one without the U.S., with the Europeans using shuttle diplomacy with the U.S. What has been the outcome of the talks? That is one of the key questions, isn't it? Well, here are two simple ways of looking at it. First, some progress has been made, but there's still a ways to go. That is something that we keep hearing time and again. Well, the second one is an even harsher one, which we don't hear much of. Almost nothing. That almost sounds like the talks are at an impasse. Well, the issue of sanctions appears to be the major sticking point, which the U.S. is concocting its own version of what sanctions should be lifted and probably when they should be lifted. For example, Iran has demanded that the U.S. remove 1,600 or so sanctions that's been imposed on Iran after Trump pulled out of the accord. Quite a lot, isn't it? Hi, I'm Kavita Ahwai. Stay tuned to today's program since it will be jam-packed. We will have two featured studio guests and two guests from abroad to get a deep look at Iran and the chances of a nuclear agreement breakthrough and whether this agreement is actually to the benefit of Iran or not.
Grand Hotel in Vienna, Austria. Site of where the Iran nuclear talks are taking place. So far, five sessions in 2 weeks. Any breakthroughs?
We are, though, nonetheless, pleased that Iran has continued to agree to engage in discussions, in direct discussions with us and with our partners on how we move forward.
Two working groups are mapping out what needs to be done. One, a list of measures that need to be taken by Iran, and another, a list of sanctions that have to be removed by the U.S. And now a third group is going to work on a matter of what's called sequence.
The most important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
The U.S. now has imposed about 1,600 sanctions. Many of them are non-nuclear related, and they even relabeled some of the ones that were nuclear related to seem that they were related to terrorism. So to dismantle this whole thing, the Iranians want the U.S. to withdraw all the sanctions that were imposed after January 2016.
Let's review that sequence one more time. The U.S. would have to come back to the JCPOA first and lift all sanctions. Iran would then follow after verification. Iran's foreign minister also talked about this, as seen here, which is identical to Araghchi's blueprint that was presented.
Time to bring in our first featured guest of the show. We have the pleasure of having Ali Rezvanpour. He's a political analyst and an analyst of the Caucasus Affairs at the Expediency Discernment Council. Mr. Rezvanpour, welcome to this program.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. My first question is a referral back to the previous JCPOA. Now, once that deal was enacted, Iran, according to reports, didn't reap the benefits of what it was entitled to under that agreement. Companies were afraid to do business with Iran because of either sanctions that may have been incurred on them, and also on the issue of human rights. They just didn't want to get into making deals with Iran. Was that the case, and will this time around, will those types of problems be alleviated?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Thank you very much. I would like to state that, you know, by taking part in JCPOA meeting right now, which is being held in different parts of sessions in Vienna, one of the most important issues, which is the concern of our Iranian people, our supreme leader, is that we should be very cautious about the process, about the space of the negotiations, about the content of the negotiations. We should be careful not just giving the permission to the negotiators, I mean the 4+1 or also 5+1, to direct the negotiations. If they wanted to direct the negotiations, we should once and for all just retreat from that, I mean, meeting and then insist on our own demands. As you mentioned about the, I mean, sanctions, about human rights, about secondary sanctions, preliminary sanctions, the Western side, I mean, the 5+1 group are not trustable, all of them, because once the JCPOA was concluded, you know, after a couple of months, they imposed again some sanctions, which we were supposed to just, you know, be relieved from those crippling sanctions. So in this process, Iranian negotiators should be careful about insisting on their own demands by just referring to our supreme leader statements that the Western side is not trustable. And after that, just try not to give the permission to the Western side to direct the negotiations. Otherwise, we won't get any benefit from those meetings. You know, our supreme leader is very clever regarding political issues. He says that, you know, the American side is trying to impose some suggestions which are disdainful, which are harmful to the Iranian benefits. That's why we do not, you know, just have any confidence in their statements, in their suggestions. By keeping the self-interest, your opposite side is insisting on one principle. What is mine is mine. What is yours is negotiable. This is a principle of international relationships. Those countries who are taking part in different kinds of negotiations with Iranian side are insisting on Iran to just take back different kinds of steps in which Iran has taken by just reneging on its own promises. The U.S. government just triggered Iran to take some steps in violation of JCPOA.
Very well. Thank you very much. We do appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We're listening to the statements here made by Mr. Rezvan Pour, a political analyst and an analyst of caucuses affairs at the Expediency Discernment Council. Thank you for your statements.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Okay, so we heard our guest there talk about some of the different aspects of these stocks, especially at the end. Stay with us. However, we're going to be right back after a quick break. Hello, welcome back. This is our in-depth section. Back in 2015, when the JCPOA was signed and hailed as a landmark agreement between Iran and the world powers, Iran was supposed to gain the economical benefits of this agreement. Yet many U.S. business restrictions actually remained. And that's on top of the U.S. scaremongering of countries and their businesses which wanted to engage with Iran. Now, the U.S. and other countries agreed to lift the economic embargo in 2012 in an effort to curb Iran's civilian nuclear program. Now, the move meant that companies in Europe, in Asia, and elsewhere were free to invest in Iran and trade with Iran, and many were interested in doing so in droves.
Cooperating with Iran's economy is itself an advantage. In this competition, anyone who enters Iran's economy faster will naturally benefit more than the other foreign companies.
This is a true demonstration of the will to try and do and go back to business in Iran.
We are looking forward to come back and to assist in any way we can the Iranians in the oil and gas, as well as many other industries.
If the conditions are required, that we can see a flow of investments in various sectors.
But while the U.S. government agreed to lift the nuclear sanctions against Iran, it imposed other sanctions, like over Iran's alleged human rights violations or alleged support for terrorism. These sanctions barred American citizens and companies from most forms of investment or trade with the country. In theory, those sanctions should affect only U.S. companies, but in reality, the law's reach goes well beyond U.S. borders. For example, U.S. financial sanctions still caused problems and made European businesses and banks subject to U.S. economic punishment. This is how much trade should have happened between the EU and Iran.
First, on the economic sector, we have agreed to enhance our economic cooperation. We will support the Iranians' bid to join the WTO. We have agreed to exchange business delegations and to cooperate on financial issues, on tourism, textiles, agriculture. And we used to be an Iranian main trade partner, and we are determined to take up that position again.
You see how much it covered there? I mean, that's back in 2015 when the JCPOA actually happened. Well, the U.S. wasn't going to have any of that. Former Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin actually threatened EU countries from doing business with Iran.
Let me first comment on Instex. I don't believe there's been any Instex transactions. As we've made clear, we are working on a Swiss channel that we have approved for humanitarian transactions. We'll continue to allow humanitarian transactions. We've warned Instex and others that they will most likely be subject to secondary sanctions depending on how they use that.
Yeah, secondary sanctions. I'm sure that's going to probably pass over. Now, do you want to get an idea about the types of contracts that didn't happen as a result of U.S. scaremongering, like you just heard there, and threats? Let's take a look at some of them. Germany Siemens, $1.6 billion. You got that technology firm to have signed that. Boeing airplanes, remember? $3 billion that Iran signed for all those airplanes. I think there were 100 of them. South Korea oil and gas, $1.8 billion. Total Petroleum from France, $4.8 billion. I could talk about 20 or 30 contracts. Well over $100 billion could have been done in sales, potential revenues, but they were lost in that year when these were signed. And after the JCPOA was signed, these, again, to have been actual agreements, MOUs, and also sales to have happened. Well, the U.S. threats, like former U.S. Treasury Secretary, was basic scaremongering. If you were a businessman, how would you react to it? Well, here's one reaction that speaks volumes.
We must be confident in the future while we know that sanctions are still there and the relief is very limited.
Notice the skepticism there. Now, this is back when the JCPOA was signed. So how would a country invest in Iran when that type of pressure was being exerted? Well, let's bring in a guest to make sense out of some of this. Scott Ritter, he was a former weapons inspector in Iraq, where he ran intelligence operations for the United Nations from 1991 to 1998 as a weapons inspector. The U.S. Treasury Department is what we're going to ask from him about how they exerted themselves. Scott Ritter, welcome. You have the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Financial Assets Control, which made it clear that no payments linked to Iran is going to actually get processed through the U.S. financial system. This is when the JCPOA was signed. So if you receive money from Iran, for example, as a bank or company, you must make sure that this money does not then go to the U.S. or to a U.S. bank or to any U.S. subsidiary. But most international companies actually go through the U.S. So how can the JCPOA even be a deal?
The U.S. has always used the SWIFT code, the banking system, as a mechanism of controlling global economics to put pressure on countries to do the bidding of the United States through the threat of secondary sanctions. That is, if a country, for instance, if the United States sanctions Iran and says you can't do business with Iran, any European country or Asian country that does business with Iran and uses the SWIFT system will be subject to secondary sanctions. This has always been one of the powerful tools that the United States Department of Treasury had, and it's clear that the Biden administration, as much as they say they want to rejoin the JCPOA, don't really mean it, because if they meant it, the Department of Treasury, which works for the President of the United States, by the way, could be told not to enforce these. New instructions could be written.
Okay, you heard it there from Scott Ritter there explaining that to us, and we appreciate that from Scott. And finally, all of this brings us to the current Vienna talks, a repeat scenario in the sense that the U.S. is not lifting all the sanctions, while it is also after dividing the sanctions and in some cases relabeling them. Well, this is what the lead negotiator of the talks from the Iranian side has said about sanctions, in which he said, we have to go back to the same model of the JCPOA.
No, we have to go back to the same model in the JCPOA. They are sanctions which should be terminated, and the U.S. president has the authority to terminate them, so that they should be obviously terminated through executive orders. And there are sanctions which are actually the result of the Congress legislation. For them, the president could only waive, and this has been mentioned in the JCPOA. So we want all those sanctions be reversed. Whatever imposed during this Trump administration, whatever imposed or reimposed or relabeled during Trump administration, and whatever is mentioned in the JCPOA should be lifted, and they should reverse whatever has been done, and I think the Americans know best how to do that.
Full of business opportunities, an investor's paradise. From the population, which is market-oriented, to natural resources, and to its transport capabilities. Here are a couple of snapshots of Iran's untapped potentials, from sea boundaries to roads, railway networks, and commercial ports. Then comes the natural resources. Agricultural products and crude oil ranking fourth in the world, to natural gas reserves coming in at number two. But the U.S. sanctions regime has bit into Iran's revenues and investors who can profit from it. Iran's GDP growth to have dipped in the negative territory, as seen here for the years 2018, 19, and 2020. Iran's auto sector, for example, has been hit hard. Production to have fallen from around 2 million units to half, around 1 million units.
In 2014, the fear that the United States instilled within the global community regarding the potential backlash financially for doing business in Iran, prohibited many European businesses from engaging with Iran after the signing of the JCPOA. And so this is why it's absolutely critical that all sanctions are lifted, not that they are categorized, and certainly that those that were reimposed and or were relabeled are lifted.
Okay, in this segment, I would like to welcome Masoud Barati. He is the administrator of the Iranian think tank network, and he has a lot that he wants to say about the talks in Vienna and the JCPOA deal, especially the whole notion of sanctions. Okay, welcome to this program. Thank you for taking the time to come here. My first question to you, give us your feedback on what you think about the talks so far.
My greeting to you also. I'm glad to be here. The talks in Vienna are being conducted within the confines of the U.S. returning back to the agreement. But U.S.'s return to the deal, from Iran's point of view, is for the U.S. to eliminate all the sanctions. In my opinion, there was no need for talks if the issue at hand was solely for the U.S. to return to the deal.
Let's take a quick time out, listen to Mr. Araghchi, his explanation of what sanctions are all about, and then we'll come back to you to get your reaction on that. Let's take a listen to what he said.
Next week, the most important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Okay. What do you think about what he has said?
The point that Mr. Araghchi is making at the beginning contradicts his ending statement and does not match what he said at the end. When we talk about a step-by-step approach, these opposes the official line and stance by the Islamic Republic. When it comes to the nuclear attacks, it may appear that the U.S. on the surface may be moving towards sanctions relief, but we had the experience from the previous agreement when there was an agreement with the P5+1. Although the agreement was the first with the U.S., the U.S. did all that it could to keep the sanctions and even expand them. It penalized major banks like French bank that it fined $9 billion after the agreement. And then the U.S. and Saudi Arabia established the Terrorist Financing Targeting Center, TFTC, in Saudi Arabia. This was the U.S. Treasury Department's branch for the West Asia region in the beginning of the 2017. This was done when former U.S. President Trump visited Saudi Arabia at that moment. Iran incurred a heavy blow at the end of the year from this organization. This is just one of many examples of how the U.S. not only keeps its sanction structure, but also expands it based on how it sees fit. Even now, during current U.S. President Joe Biden's term, prior to him coming into office, a 50-strong task force specializing in sanctions was set up, consisting of Mr. Cohen and Mr. Nephew and other officials from both parties. This was set up at the U.S. National Security Agency with the aim of developing and expanding sanctions. If we are seeing that the sanctions pressure is not as intense as before, it's not because they are negotiating with us, but it's because of the sanction cycle. Definitely after 1 or 2 years, there will be new sanctions that will be applied or will come about.
Okay, thank you very much. That's some insightful stuff there. We do appreciate your comments, Masoud Barati, Iranian think tank network. He is the administrator of that think tank. Thank you so much for joining us here in Economic Dubai. Okay, lots of good stuff there from our guest, which I'm sure you'll be thinking about. At this point, we are going to take a quick break here on Economic Divide, but do stay with us. We'll be right back.
The toughest and most comprehensive multilateral sanctions that the Iranian government has ever faced.
17 specific sanctions against Iran's largest steel.
It's all about the sanctions with the U.S. when it comes to Iran. The U.S. has sanctioned all that it could, from Iranian officials to industries and even Iran's leader.
An executive order imposing hard-hitting sanctions on the Supreme Leader of Iran and the Office of the Supreme Leader of Iran and many others.
How is that for diplomacy? The U.S. calls it the maximum pressure campaign.
That they will face mounting financial isolation.
But even according to their own officials, it has failed.
It's been many years since the United States has had that kind of...
Take Rob Malley, U.S.'s Iran envoy. He has said that the maximum pressure on Iran has failed, and that a return to the nuclear deal is the first step out of the morass. His suggestion? To offer Tehran a Goldilocks-style deal. Enough sanctions relief so that Iran will return to the deal, but not so much that it would leave the U.S. President Joe Biden vulnerable to hardliners at home. The U.S. side has said that they have a list of measures on both sides to come back into compliance. The next step is to sequence these to allow both sides to save face.
Iran has been slowly moving away from its JCPOA commitments and coping with the sanctions. In the past months, with Biden having made no progress in lifting the sanctions, Iran has reached 1 million barrels of oil per day in its oil export, and the capital that was blocked in Iraq, South Korea, and Japan, well, it has become more accessible to it. I mean, Iran is getting past that crisis, it's getting past the COVID-19 pandemic by signing contracts for export of its domestically made coronavirus. I'm saying all this to point in the direction that whether or not a deal takes place, and in this program we've tried to toe the line in the middle by bringing the guests and the viewpoints that we have, that deal or not, Iran is going to move forward. It will progress. So it's time for the West, in particular the U.S., to make its mind up whether it wants to make a deal with Iran or not. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. For me, Kaveh Tafli, and the whole team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The immortal message of Imam Ali. In the name of God, the all-merciful, the all-compassionate. Hello, dear friends, and our condolences to all on the anniversary of the tragic days that we've been passing through. The Islamic Republic of Iran is draped in black and people are busy since yesterday attending mourning ceremonies to commemorate the anniversary of the tragic days that ended in the martyrdom of the icon of justice and the gateway of wisdom, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, who despite his departure from the world, remains immortal. His sermons and aphorisms have continued to reverberate over the past millennium and four centuries as guidelines for the seekers of truth in view of their flawless eloquence and timeless wisdom which no other mortal has been able to match. Please stay with us for a special program on the eve of his martyrdom. Our program is titled Immortal Message of Imam Ali.